Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin, and every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve speaks with Tim Carmichael, Chief Data Officer of the Shaloub Group, a luxury retailer based in Dubai, and former Chief Data Officer of the British Army. Tim and Steve talk about what can happen when leaders empower their people to act and consider how CDOs, like CISOs, can serve as interpreters for members of the board. They also explore strategies for hiring and keeping the best talent in a competitive market.
Tim, thank you very much indeed for joining me on the podcast. Great to have you. You're in Dubai, I think, at the moment.
That's right, Steve. Yes, so good evening from Dubai. Good afternoon to you. And yes, I've been living and working in Dubai for the last 2 years or so.
Oh, fantastic. Cooling down now, I think, a little bit.
Yeah, thankfully. It gets a bit hot in the high summer. So now is the time when people are constantly saying, oh, this is the perfect time of year.
And you're the Chief Data Officer for the Shaloub Group, which is a luxury retailer. Tell us a bit about your background and your career, because I think you were first a Chief Data Officer for the British military before moving into retail. So that doesn't seem like a natural transition, if I could put it that way. But how did you come to get involved in being CDO, first of all, with the military and then obviously with the Shaloub Group?
I think that's a very fair observation that it might seem like a strange transition. So let me try and demystify it a bit. So I was a career army officer and delighted with that role. Lucky me, I had work that was a vocation from when I was very young, and that matured, and I went through Sandhurst and joined the British Army. Now, of course, in doing that, you start very young, very inexperienced, and very bad at doing all the things you should be really good at. And so there's a great learning environment there. And gradually over my career, I bounced between technical type appointments and then operations and strategy and policy type appointments, with leadership thrown in pretty much as a constant throughout. And as you work your way up the pyramid, so to speak, they came to a point where the British Army wanted to create its first chief data officer. I had a background in telecommunications and engineering and data and information more generally, and of course, also an understanding of the organization. So the leader of the army, the rather grandly titled Chief of the General Staff, asked me to become the first Chief Data Officer. And he empowered me with one sentence. He said, Tim, I need you to help us make evidence-based decisions. And I think that's a really great descriptor of what a Chief Data Officer brings. They don't take the decisions necessarily, and they don't clearly want people to throw away their experience or their judgment, but certainly it's in the purview of a CDO to enable people to lean on evidence, to lean on facts, let's call that data, properly interpreted, to deliver insights. So I was appointed as the Army's first Chief Data Officer. It was a bit of a voyage of discovery for everyone. What does this do and how does it work? And when you think of any professional military, pretty much globally, they're kind of merrily schizophrenic. On one side, you get the public persona of the military, soldiers in camouflage, wielding weapons, doing the things only soldiers in camouflage can do. And clearly, that can range from helping people domestically if there's flooding, for instance, helping the local authorities, right up to full-scale warfighting and lots of points in between. So there's very much that sort of tactical operational part of it. But then the schizophrenia is you flip on the other side of the same coin and you discover that actually the British military, as with many other militaries, is a significant global multi-billion not-for-profit organization that has to run itself as a business, as a not-for-profit type business, and deliver the outputs it's required to deliver by the government in a way that are affordable and sustainable. And so in that respect, there are very similar challenges between a chief data officer in the military and the public sector as there are in business. Now, clearly, there's a very different context, but that's kind of the way it worked in the military. Now, after some time in that role, I was enjoying it so much, I didn't want to stop, but it's apparent that all good things have to come to an end. So I decided to leave the army and surf the function and to change sectors. And my approach was to say, look, it turns out I can do this. It turns out I can add value as a chief data officer or similar title. So why don't I go and do that in the private sector? And sometime later, a friend of mine recruited me into Shell Hoop Group, a friend from my network recruited me into Shell Hoop Group. And I was subsequently appointed as their chief data officer. Now, what has luxury retail got to do with the military? Nothing at all. But that doesn't matter because actually the challenges that you face are very similar. The challenges for anybody in a data leadership role, more generically, I would call, are really straightforward. It's helped the business understand four things, and they're with growing levels of sophistication. So first one is what's going on? Then there's, and why is that going on? And then what's likely to happen next? And the fourth question is, and what would be the best thing to do about that? And in data and analytics terms, I've just summarized descriptive, diagnostic, predictive, and prescriptive analytics. Clearly, the further up you go, the more advanced the use cases get. And that's common to any organization. Trying to figure out the best thing to do, given the circumstances they face, given a finite set of inputs, and a certainly targeted set of desired outcomes. How does that all work? And I think the last thing that I would wrap up in terms of commonality between them is clearly there's a leadership and management responsibility that's common to most of those environments when you're in a data leadership role.
That's a great sort of summary of how you came to be where you are, indeed the role that data has to play in an organization. Now, there'll be some people listening to this thinking, well, that's great, but you know, I'm not in that position. So how does an organization become data-driven and make those evidence-based data-driven decisions? What are the sort of stepping stones towards being able to do that effectively?
Well, the first one is a cultural decision, and it's a business decision too. Essentially, does the organization feel that it could make better decisions that would unlock more value with or without data? So if, and I gave the example from the army, there was a strong heritage of experiential decision-making, that's worked for years. Why change it is the question. Well, of course, typically now, our environments move and change so fast and the decision cycle is so short that you need more than just your own judgment to help you. So the first thing that helps a business understand the imperative for change is to show that actually the world has changed around you. And whilst we wouldn't want to throw away any of your experience, we need to help you with better, faster, more accurate decision making. So it's a cultural change, and it's an acceptance that whilst we're doing what we do really well, we could do even better if. And I think that's an important approach to start off with. And as an outsider coming in to a different sector, I bring with me a certain level of experience and understanding, but clearly I need to bring with me the humility that says, I don't know it all, and I need to work in partnership with people. So I think very much at the heart of delivering that kind of change is this sense of collaboration and trying to knock down silos so that you get away from tribalism that gets in the way of change.
I think some of the examples that you give there, you know, things like tribalism, culture change, transformation, those are all challenges and issues that certainly chief information security officers are facing today. It is about how do they make the case for better use of data in order to build out stronger resilience, protect the business very much more. And you said something there about having to work more closely with different business leaders. Now, that is something that I'm constantly asked about. You know, how do I go about doing that? Because if you've got, and most organizations perhaps don't have, you know, a clear-cut two camps, but certainly you will have the technical people, and a lot of security people fit into that category. And then you'll have the business people. And so forging links across those, whether it be trying to come up with a common language or focusing on key strategic issues, is challenging. Any advice you've got for people who are trying to bridge that gap, to have those conversations, meaningful conversations?
You've used a really important word there, and it's language. And I see myself as an interpreter. And I don't think it's too hard and fast camps, of course. There are many business leaders that are very digitally and technically literate and know how to harness all the potential of that which modern digital infrastructure can bring to them. There are others who are comfortable in the way that they've done it for years, and you need to be able to speak to both of those sets of organizations. Just as within what you might call the technical community, there are some who are more or less technical, depending on their level of expertise. But I see myself as an interpreter, and I should be able to speak the language of the business in a way that they understand and introduce into that conversation the potential that is there for people to be able to co-opt in order to unlock value that otherwise was not available to them. And equally, I need to be able to turn in the other direction and articulate what the business priorities and needs and requirements are from the business to a group of specialists, many of whom are entirely business literate, but some of whom are much more comfortable in their technical specialist space. Interestingly for me, that's a straightforward enough thing to do because in a previous life, I was an interpreter. I was an English-French interpreter. So bringing those skill sets of avoiding a dialogue of the deaf is an important part of my role. And of course, with that comes all sorts of challenges on how do you render something as complex and nebulous as data and analytics, and in your case, in terms of cybersecurity and network security, how do you render that accessible to someone who has no background, no specialist background in that area? And I think that's a real challenge. So clearly, you're leaning on simplicity, you're leaning on the power of the metaphor, and explaining things in a way that you try and make as digestible as possible. I'll give you a little worked example. So I am blessed to have a really talented team around me, and they've created some great products which are there ready for the business to use. And essentially, we license those internally to the business. We have a subscription model internally for the business. And the analogy I use is rather clumsily, we sell cars. Now, you can choose to buy a fairly basic entry-level family car, or you can choose to drive a Ferrari, depending on what your needs are. What we will help you do is help you use the car and drive the car in a safe way, and we will deliver the car to you, and we'll even show you how it works and which buttons to press. But what we won't ever do is tell you where to drive or how fast. We'll explain the rules of the road. But it's not for us to say what you do with the potential of that vehicle in this case, in this analogy, and which journey you go on. So true it is for data as well. We provide the wherewithal for people to harness analytics to generate insights that drive value. If they choose to embrace that in a way that is imaginative and leans on curiosity, you'll soon see them taking really interesting journeys in that vehicle that we provide. But equally, some of them just choose to park it up on a driveway for a while they consider what to do with it. And to a certain degree, that's fine, providing that's not where they intend to keep it, gathering dust or sand in the Dubai environment.
I think some great takeaways there from a security standpoint as well, because I think increasingly that is the same with security professionals. It is about providing that guidance, advice. But ultimately, of course, it comes down to being a business decision at the end of the day as to how the business intends to go forward and adopt some of those things. So some really good parallels there, I think. Let's change tack a little bit now, because I made the point right at the beginning that you're working in Dubai. The Chalhoub Group, of course, doesn't just operate in one of the Emirates. It operates outside of that. It's a multinational organization. So I'm curious to understand the importance of culture, particularly when it comes to some of the things you've been talking about with regard to data there. How do you manage the service you provide, if I could put it that way, across multiple geographies, multiple cultures?
Well, I mean, and that's a really important point, precisely because we are a family of 13 to 14,000 employees across multiple markets, mainly Gulf-based, but we spread beyond the Gulf as well. Precisely because of that, Chalhoub Group has been super strong on ensuring it has a culture that everyone can subscribe to, noting that people will come from different backgrounds and different sets of expectations. And so we have, as a company, worked really hard to create that common ground culture. And that is, you know, the buzzword we use is one team, one culture. And I think that's really important because it's not just a buzzword written on the corporate wall. It's there and it's lived. And so we have a set of guiding principles that we use. We have a set of values and we have a clearly articulated purpose. And all of those things resonate to a greater or lesser degree with our people. And if I were to pick a few bits out of those, I love the fact that our purpose is three words. If you don't know what you're doing, go back to those three words. We're here to inspire, exhilarate, and delight. And I love that. What a wonderfully upbeat purpose for a business to have. We're here to inspire our customers with the products we offer and the promise of luxury for them at a time where times are hard for some people. And so that's a really important promise to give people. We're here to exhilarate them with the experiences that we provide for them, not just the products that we provide. And of course, to delight them in the way that we serve them and in the way that we help them, their families, their friends, feel better about themselves and feel better about the world. And so that purpose is really strong when it's focused on our customers, but also, of course, we can play it back on ourselves. And that's what I like too. I would love to think that my team feels, maybe not every day and maybe not every hour of every day, but frequently enough, pretty inspired about what they do and about what they see the business doing, inspired to be better at what they do, inspired to grow and learn. They're exhilarated when they have success, and that success is measurable and tangible. I'm always exhilarated when I get that, oh, wow, moment from the business where for the first time they can see something that they haven't been able to do before. And of course, we're delighted when that works well for the business and we're adding value to our customers. So that whole purpose has meaning. And the meaning behind that purpose, of course, is it makes good business sense to have it. And I think one last bit on our culture, which I'd love to highlight with you, is amongst our guiding principles, the things that we always reach out and touch if we need to, there's a great one called, "We create magic together." I belong to an organization who is unafraid and unabashed to say, we create magic together. And of course, in a luxury environment, that makes sense because by definition, luxury is discretionary. Luxury is a choice. It's not existential. In a previous life, I worked in an organization where, frankly, some of our buzzwords were very existential. And so it's joyous working in an organization that wants to and is prepared to shout to the rooftops, we create magic together. I think that's really cool. Lucky me.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I'm sure that a number of people listening to this will be sitting there thinking, well, there must be some silver bullets in all of this, you know, because if you look at our industry, the security space, we're always talking about skill shortage, how tough it is to try to attract people, retain them. You know, people move on very quickly because they can earn far more somewhere else than they can perhaps in the organization that they're at. What are some of those tips that people can take away from this regarding trying to create more team, family, exhilaration or magic if they're so inclined in their own organizations?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough, isn't it? And people talk about the war on talent. I don't think I like that phrase. I think maybe the challenge for talent or the fight for talent maybe, but not on talent. Nevertheless, we face similar challenges and you would expect us to in this region and globally. And that's why we recruit globally. But we also recruit with an eye for local talent, because we're very keen to support the agenda of, here in Dubai, the Emirati government, but equally in other markets like Saudi, the need to employ and embrace local employees so that they can grow their skill sets in an area that maybe hasn't got a strong heritage in that country. So we try and strike a balance in the way we recruit. I think you recruit on reputation. And I don't mean sitting back on your laurels. I think you daily earn the right and re-earn the right to recruit on your reputation. And word of mouth clearly is a strong thing. So for us recruiting, we will always start with that rather LinkedIn phrase, talent knows talent. And we'll ask our own colleagues to reach out to their networks whenever there's a vacancy. And of course, lucky me, I live in a growth environment now. I live in a growing team that's seeking extra talent and extra skills in order to deliver what we've set ourselves up to deliver. So in terms of recruitment, I think your reputation matters and the nature of the offer matters in terms of the work. I think typically people in my team and elsewhere in my business, and no doubt in your line of work as well, are motivated by a mixture of three or four things. So they might, of course, be motivated by the leader and motivated to join or to stay because of the nature of that person. I'm wary of that because I think you end up in a position where you have a single point of success or failure if you play that wrong. Yeah. But I'm certain that people are motivated by at least three other things. The first one is they want to work in a place that is a great place to work. They want to work in a culture, like I spoke about, that is exhilarating and that inspires them and that allows them to be the best they can be. That's the first point, I think. I think the second point is that they wish to work in a place that champions their growth and their development and empowers them to grow, gives them the time and the space to do that and celebrates their achievements. I would hate to work in an environment that insists that the version of me that turned up on day one is the only version they need ever throughout my tenure there, because I think that would be uninspiring, but also quite difficult to sustain. So personal and professional growth. And for me and my team are relatively young, super energetic, and relatively ambitious. And so that's a really important part of the offer. And I think the third part of the offer is also about a fair package in terms of the compensation. Now, we choose not to compete with certain digital natives. We can't. We choose not to compete with certain sectors, for instance, financial services, where typically it's significantly higher pay. And that's fine. And it's fine because as long as it's fair and people don't think they're being taken for a ride, the other parts of the offer really matter too. So it's a balanced offer that we look for. And I think that's as effective in the recruitment as it is in the retention. But if you emphasize only one part of those, it's like having a three-legged stool with one leg shorter than the other and it'll fall over.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a really succinct way of encapsulating, I think, the way in which the business world is going to have to change. But a slightly cheeky question for you, I guess. Do you use a data-driven approach to your recruitment and retention strategies?
Yeah, we do, in that we gather information from our colleagues about what matters to them. So certainly in retention, we have a mechanism by which, and this is group-wide, so it's not just within the data team, which is clearly a relatively modest part of the group in terms of size and in terms of longevity. But we gather information and survey information and responses from our teams to understand what's motivating them, what's demotivating them. We have a great expression for feedback, that we welcome feedback as a gift. And when feedback is given in the spirit of, it could be even better if, as opposed to, well, that was pretty awful, wasn't it? It's a completely different tone of voice and it's much more constructive. So we will play back that feedback to understand what's going on in a way that can be delivered maybe anonymously, maybe where there's psychological safety, where maybe doing it face-to-face is a bit more of a challenge. And in that way, we can understand what is the voice inside our business, what does matter to our employees at scale. Now, clearly, I enjoy the conversations I have with the members of my team, and I know that the managers and leaders inside my team also really enjoy that. And you can therefore enrich that feedback at scale with local anecdote and local splashes of color, if you like. And I think you need to strike a balance between the two. And it's interesting, it was as a result of some really good, honest, transparent feedback from one of my team members that made me realize that that three-legged stool I was speaking about earlier in the year was becoming unbalanced. And I needed to take some corrective action that would essentially allow us to retain more readily the skill set that we have. And why do you want retention? Well, you want retention because for us, that's where our intellectual property lies. We don't want stagnation. But we do want some longevity from certain team members, the majority of team members, to feel invested in the success of the organization and in their own growth, because that allows us to harvest the intellectual property that is inside their heads and inside our platform. And that makes us successful as a team and therefore as a company.
Tim, it's been great talking to you. Thank you for sharing some of the insights, particularly around not just data, which of course was where we started, but also around leadership, around managing people, and certainly giving us an insight, I think, into a different way for perhaps a number of people listening to this that they might like to consider working with their teams, irrespective of whether it's in one country or across multiple jurisdictions. So, as I said, thank you very much indeed for spending the time and indeed being so open in sharing some of those thoughts.
It's my pleasure, Steve. I hope that your podcast listeners get something of value out of this. And if they get nothing else, then at least you and I have enjoyed making magic together.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks to this week's guest, Tim Carmichael. We'll be back with a new episode in a week. In the meantime, we ask listeners that you take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening and give us a 5-star rating. And if you have the time, write a short review. And we also want to make sure to introduce you to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in depth on the hottest topics in information security.
In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen, and of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. If there's a topic or a question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, senior producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Thanks for listening.